Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. It's often said your brand is what people say about you when you're not around. Leaders in Tempe now have a better understanding of what people think of their city. 6 months after hiring a firm to help craft a branding initiative, council members received a report on that market research. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes joins me to talk about the findings. And Christina, what did they learn?
Well, Mark, before we get to the specific finding, let's see where you land among those surveyed. So when I say Tempe, what words do you think best describe it?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is College Town ASU.
Well, that's pretty good. So did a lot of other people. The best descriptors listed in this research were progressive, ASU, and College Town. So that's based on focus groups, one-on-one interviews, and surveys among residents, business, and community leaders. When asked about Tempe's greatest assets, ASU was at the top. And when it came to greatest opportunities, lakefront development was number one.
So, Christina, who's actually doing this research?
Tempe hired a Tennessee-based firm called North Star. They've done branding work with communities in Illinois, Ohio, California, and other states.
And so now they've gathered opinions from people who live and work in Tempe. What about people who don't really have a connection to the city?
Well, North Star also talked to people who live in other Valley cities, as well as people from the LA area, because that's Tempe's top visitor market. That survey asked about 200 people to look at a list of words and phrases and choose the ones that best describe Tempe. The most popular responses were home to ASU, College Town, Mill Avenue, and downtown.
Well, it sounds like they gathered a lot of lists with adjectives and phrases. What about actual comments?
They gathered those, too. For example, they asked people about their perceptions before visiting Tempe and got these responses. I heard it's packed with students, hot and empty. I thought it would be the same as other areas of Arizona. Also, they asked if your perception changed after visiting. How did it change? Here are some of those responses. I realized that the city had a unique atmosphere from its college-age citizens, and the partying wasn't too obnoxious or in your face.
That's high quality right there.
Apparently, you weren't there then.
No.
The other response, what changed my perception was the fact that there was a couple things to do other than just look at the university.
Well, so after 6 months of research, what was the firm's big takeaway?
Branding consultant Ed Barlow summarized the findings with this single sentence.
For those drawn to a place brimming with energy, Tempe is home to Arizona State University and strategically centered in Arizona, yet standing apart, where hearts and sciences lead the way.
Now, Christina, most of this sounds pretty complimentary. Did North Star hear anything negative about Tempe?
Yeah, they did ask both residents and visitors about negative impressions. Homelessness came up among both groups. When it came to Tempe, residents and business leaders, being landlocked was also considered a challenge.
So what's going to happen with all this research?
Well, that sentence that North Star created is meant to guide the city in future marketing and planning efforts. By the end of the year, council members are expected to get a final report, which may include a new logo, tagline, and other creative pieces.
That's KJZZ's Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
10 years ago today, Mark Godeau, the notorious Baseline Killer, was arrested. It was the end of a violent stretch in Phoenix history in which Godeau terrorized the Valley, killing and sexually assaulting women in broad daylight. And around the same time, the so-called serial shooter was driving the city streets, shooting and killing people seemingly at random. Arizona Republic reporter Michael Kiefer has been covering these notorious Phoenix murders for the last decade, and now he's written a 5-part series about it all. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with him about what it was like to report on this summer of fear then and now.
So what was going on this summer 10 years ago?
It started out kind of slowly. I mean, there were isolated incidents. There were animals shot. There were murders that weren't necessarily connected. You know, two ladies killed in a lunch wagon over on the west side, and the police assumed, well, it's probably a drug deal gone bad. It wasn't until, I want to say around March of 2006, when it had been going on for a year already, when it started, the police started to get really concerned and realized that there were two, possibly three, serial killers on the loose. At first, the serial shooters, who we called the serial shooter, was shooting with a .22. And that all ended on December 29th, December 30th of 2005. And then they disappeared for a while. And then this other killer who was snatching women off the street started to emerge. But the moment it went viral was when it was the end of June 2005, June 30th, when Carmen Miranda was taken from a car wash on Thomas Road, right at 28th Street, and it was caught on video, on a surveillance video. And when we saw that video, which then the TVs, stations put out to everyone, then the fear was really, really palpable.
Can you describe, kind of, for people who weren't here, people who don't remember, were young then, what was this like in the Valley? Was this fear pervasive?
People were confused, but, you know, they confused the two killers. They knew that there were a lot of murders. They didn't know the details. They were striking everywhere. I remember taking the dog out for a walk at night, and every time a car would come slowly down the street, I'd start looking in both directions. Where can I run to? What about the dog? Can I go over that wall? When you went in neighborhoods where, for example, where the Baseline Killer struck, people were, especially working people, were really, really aware, and women, you know, who had to ride the bus to work were quite concerned. People were thinking, should I go to the movies? Should we have a picnic? Should we go out for dinner? This was not isolated. It was unpredictable, and nobody knew who it was. The one set, the serial shooter, would shoot out of a window, and then the car would zoom off, and nobody really got a good look at it. The Baseline Killer would strike, take people right off, women, right off the street, and then sort of leave them close to where he had taken them with a bullet in their heads and their pants unzipped and disappear.
What was it like then as a reporter to be covering this?
Exactly 10 years ago today, September 6th, it was my daughter's birthday, and we were out for dinner and came home fairly late, and I had been in bed for maybe 15 minutes when my phone rang, and it was my editor saying, hey, they just arrested a person they think is the Baseline Killer. Can you go? And I wasn't sure I was awake, but I was like, yeah, I'll go. And spent the next 48 hours or so trying to figure out who this person, Mark Godot, was. It was exhausting, but at the same time, it was exciting. So, but that's just the beginning. Then I had them all through their trials, and the trials went on for years. And so you'd sit there and you'd listen to this painful litany of anguish, injury, fear, sorrow, grief. It was taxing. And by the time it was over, I remember the Dale Hausner trial, for instance. There had been a few moments towards the end that I still cry when I try to repeat some of the things that the surviving victims said. Claudia Gutierrez Cruz, who apologized to her sister for not being there to protect her from the serial shooter. The mother of Liliana Sanchez, who told the jury, I wish I could pull my heart out and show you my pain.
Yeah. So having covered this for so long and then writing this piece as a journalist, I know we like to stay far away from our subjects, right? I wonder, after having covered this for so long and writing this new piece in the first person, some of it, what was that experience like for you?
My editor, we've had a few pieces like this. I start off in the third person, and my editor says, you know, what I miss here are the stories, the outtakes. You tell me about these trials, and I want those in there. So my editor said, I want you to tell this in the first person. So, you know, the first person's not, it's not really about you. It's a vantage point. It's a way of saying, look, I was there, and this isn't theoretical. I watched this happen.
All right. Well, great work, Michael Kiefer with The Republic. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5, along with The Takeaways' John Hockenberry. I'm Mark Brody.
The New York Times profiled Dearborn County, Indiana last week, noting this community was moving opposite to a national trend of finding alternatives to incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders. In fact, this county in the southern part of Indiana does not have a high rate of violent crime. Its population living below the poverty line is below average for the state and nation, and yet Dearborn County has one of the highest incarceration rates in the U.S. About 1 in 10 adults in the county find themselves in jail, prison, or on probation.
Dearborn County Defense Attorney Doug Garner says the situation makes it difficult to address serious social problems in the community.
You wonder why people reoffend. Well, you know, you put them in jail for 2 years and you send them out at 22 with a felony conviction. They don't have, they're not getting rehabilitation in jail. They're not getting training in jail. They're getting out 22 years old with a felony conviction. You know, yeah, they're probably going to reoffend at that point. And so, you know, we're spending $30,000 or $40,000 a year per inmate to put them in jail, and a fraction of that money could be spent on, you know, rehabilitation, drug treatment, with a better outcome.
This aggressive prosecution rate is the policy of County Prosecutor Aaron Negengarten. He joins us now. Aaron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on the show.
What's going on in this region that causes this high rate of both crime and incarceration?
Well, I think our close proximity to Cincinnati causes a lot of a crime that runs over from the Cincinnati area into our jurisdiction. But I think also it's a reflection of the hard work that is done by law enforcement, the judges, the probation department, the community corrections department, and our office.
But would you describe it as a success to have that number of individuals in prison, jail, or on probation?
I would describe that if you look at incarceration rates, that's just one aspect of the story. What the story didn't tell was the number of alternatives to incarceration that we offer. For example, really only 1 in 10 people who are arrested and charged in Dearborn County are sent to prison, and it's actually less than that, but that's approximate. So there are a number of evidence-based programs that we have in place that weren't noted in the story.
But nevertheless, that is one of the highest rates of incarceration in the country.
Well, per capita, it's a high rate of incarceration, but that just means we're holding people accountable. Given the number of programs that we offer for alternatives to incarceration, I think it does spell the fact that we are working very hard in Dearborn County to hold people accountable to the law.
And would you say that policies elsewhere are not holding people accountable?
I would say that policies apparently in San Francisco and Cincinnati are not holding people accountable.
Let me play you something that was said by someone who I think that you know, a Dearborn County defense attorney, Doug Garner, who talked about the limitations and inadequate alternatives in Dearborn County and Ohio County.
You know, normally in a bigger city, I think you would be able to find drug treatment that doesn't immediately feed them into the correctional system. But what happens here is that either the school or the hospital ends up calling law enforcement to deal with it. And so all these people immediately are tagged as in the criminal system. And it's not long, if you've got a drug problem, that you end up with a felony conviction. And then at 18 or 19, if you have a felony conviction, it's very difficult to move forward at that point.
Would you agree that people are being tagged with felonies at the early part of their lives, and therefore that limits their ability to do anything subsequently?
No, I disagree with that, and that's in fact not accurate. I mean, in Indiana, there's often many opportunities to avoid getting a felony conviction. First and foremost, we have a diversion program, and we've recently expanded the diversion program with the revision of the criminal code. For example, we now allow felonies to be diverted given if they get assessed, participate in evidence-based programs such as online programs and a classroom. They have to also complete counseling as directed based on their assessment. I would say that that's an opportunity to avoid a conviction altogether. Now, some people don't want to work that hard, and so they end up with a felony conviction. The drug court that's been in place for a number of years has also been available and has been successful. And I would also note that That allows people to avoid a felony conviction. Also note that people on felony convictions can frequently find work in the area. In fact, I know some people who have been convicted of felony convictions making more money than myself. So I would disagree with that characterization that these people have no other alternative. What is unfortunate is for most people to come to the point where they're ready to seek rehabilitation, they need to be looking at a significant penalty in jail.
At a moment when the federal government and other states and localities are moving away from incarcerating nonviolent offenders, drug offenders, to have the rate of incarceration that you have seems that you're very much in moving in the other direction. Would you agree that that's the case?
I would agree that the country, parts of the country, are probably headed in the wrong direction on this issue. But I would disagree that these are nonviolent offenders that are going to prison. I disagree with that assessment. Who is being sent to prison are people who pose a threat to public safety. Some of those people happen to be drug addicts, some of them aren't, but they still pose a threat to public safety.
And even if they haven't been convicted of a violent offense, like assault or armed robbery or something.
An unrehabilitated drug addict is dangerous. First off, they're stealing. They're stealing from either elderly people or they're exploiting their own parents and grandparents. They're stealing from the community. They're forging checks wherever they can find a way to get money. They're burglarizing houses. They're operating while impaired. Furthermore, if they have children, I haven't met an unrehabilitated drug addict yet who wasn't neglecting their children in some manner or another. These are issues that have to be addressed. They cannot just operate with impunity without a consequence when they're posing a risk to the public safety of the citizens of our jurisdiction.
Aaron Negengard is a prosecutor for Dearborn County. He spoke to us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. It appears there's a relationship between sea levels in the Pacific Ocean and global surface temperatures on Earth, and scientists at the University of Arizona are trying to figure out what exactly that relationship is. Cheryl Pizer is one of them. She's a PhD candidate at the U of A who studies sea level rise and climate. She's also the first author of a paper looking into this. And Cheryl, how does the Earth's temperature relate to the sea levels in different parts of the Pacific?
So the way we usually look at it is that when temperature rises, sea level rises because the water expands with the heat. But what we found was that we could look at the sea level in the Pacific to predict what would happen with the global temperature.
Well, what is different about the Pacific than any of the other oceans that makes this the ocean to study for this?
It's a good question. The Pacific takes up a large area, and the changes in the heat storage in the Pacific seem to really affect the global temperature.
So basically, as the water levels rise in the Pacific, the temperatures on Earth goes down, is that right? Or at least doesn't go up.
Right, so what we found, it's actually a specific pattern in the Pacific where when sea level rise is high in the western Pacific off the coast of Asia, that's a time that we find the natural temperature of Earth to be a little cooler. So what that means, temperature on Earth has a natural cycle, and that's always going to be superimposed on the human-caused warming. And so when we have a time that would be cooler with human-caused warming, we end up just having a slowing of the warming.
So what do you do with that information? I mean, we hear so much about ways that we can try to slow down the sort of human-caused climate change, but it seems to me there's not much we can do about the sea level in either parts of the Pacific Ocean.
So the relationship that we see is basically driven by natural cycles, but what it can help us with is that when we see this higher sea level in the Western Pacific, it happens before the rise in global temperature. So it allows us to predict what type of temperature rise we'll actually see. And on the other end with sea level, because it is driven by global temperature changes, any reduction in greenhouse gas emissions is going to help reduce that risk that we have of sea level rise.
Are there different attributes in the east and the west part of the Pacific Ocean that lead to this disparity between sea level, you know, whether it's up or down in one part of the ocean and whether temperatures are steady or going up?
Yes. People are probably familiar with El Nino events, and those occur in the Pacific. And in the Pacific Ocean, we always have trade winds, and they're going to blow from east to west. And so water piles up in the Western Pacific, and so it's actually always a little higher in the Western Pacific. Sea level is actually not uniform globally. We have areas where sea level is higher and areas where it's lower. And so in the Pacific, you always have this tilt. And what we're looking at is changes in the tilt.
What is next for this research? I mean, what do you still need to figure out?
We would like to continue to look into this to get an idea of why the Pacific can affect global temperature so quickly. We know that the Pacific is important for the global climate, but we want to understand the mechanism for this release of heat from the ocean into the atmosphere that lets us see this change in global temperature.
Cheryl Pizer is a doctoral candidate at the University of Arizona and the first author of the paper being published online in Geophysical Research Letters, dealing with the amount of sea level rise in the Pacific Ocean being used to estimate future global surface temperatures. Cheryl, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
What lessons can an ancient civilization hold for a modern city? Well, it turns out plenty. Michael Smith is helping translate them. He's an archaeology professor at ASU and director of the school's Teotihuacan Research Lab in southern Mexico, which studies the Mesoamerican city. And Michael, are you still finding new things about this ancient civilization now?
Well, Teotihuacan was a huge city. It covered 20 square kilometers, and only a very small part of it has been excavated. But the whole thing has been mapped. But yeah, new things are being discovered all the time. There's a lot of work to do.
Like what kinds of things are you finding?
Well, there's an ASU project right now that I'm not directly involved in, and they're excavating what is probably a palace compound. And since they've just begun, I can't tell you their results, but it's going to give us ideas of what was going on sort of in downtown Teotihuacan and the civic structures. My kind of archaeology is more looking at the houses where people lived, trying to figure out daily life, what were social patterns like. And one thing that we've found through my work and the work of others is that the average people of Teotihuacan had a very high quality of life. They lived in these luxurious houses. And it's a little bit surprising. The kinds of houses they lived in were quite large, spacious rooms open to the air with drains in the courtyards. The walls were covered with plaster and painted with murals and gods and animals and so on. In most other ancient societies, that would be described a noble's residence, an elite residence. But at Teotihuacan, that was the standard way that people lived.
When you spend as much time as you do studying ancient civilizations, and specifically this one, do you start to see any parallels between society then and society now?
Yeah, there are similarities and there are differences. One of the things that strikes me, and it's not just about Teotihuacan, but about most ancient cities, is that urban universal around the world and through time is the importance of neighborhoods. Any city today, any city in the past, there are always neighborhoods. And it's partly because people move into a city, there's lots of people, it's big, and people want to live their life on a smaller scale. And so it's a real universal.
Do you find that there are lessons that we can and maybe should be thinking about in society today that we could figure out from studying civilizations like Teotihuacan?
Well, I think one of the lessons has to do with neighborhoods. It's the importance of neighborhoods suggests that is something that we really need to pay attention to today. I don't think we're going to get specific advice. You know, Mayor Stanton's not going to call us and say, hey, how they do neighborhoods at Teotihuacan? I want to fix Phoenix neighborhoods. But on the other hand, the fact that neighborhoods were a really important part of cities in the past and the present shows that this is something fundamental and that really it's a way to sort of improve life in cities is to focus on the neighborhood level.
How do you try to make your research on these very old ancient civilizations relevant to people now, be they students at ASU or just sort of the general public?
Well, there's two ways. One is to look at the historical continuity. Teotihuacan, these people were the ancestors of the Aztecs, and the Aztecs were the ancestors of the Mexican people. And a lot of the Mexican-American people in Arizona are descended from these ancient people of Teotihuacan. So there's a historical continuity which generates interest. But beyond that, I think looking at some of these patterns, what's similar and what's different about ancient life? And how is Teotihuacan similar to, say, Phoenix today, and how is it different? By focusing on those things, I think people get an idea of what life was like. People know what cities are. They know what neighborhoods are. And by studying those aspects of ancient cities, we can tie in with people's experience today.
Other than the area of neighborhoods, do you find other similarities between Teotihuacan and modern Phoenix?
Well, there's a number of similarities that perhaps are more superficial. I mean, Teotihuacan was one of the few ancient cities in Mexico laid out according to a grid. You know, it was 16 degrees east of north, but basically all the buildings followed the same orientation, and Phoenix does. Now, maybe that's just happenstance. I wouldn't want to read too much into that. But the fact that the city was large, it had rich and poor, it had different occupations, economic activity was key. And just on a very broad scale, the way the city operated was sort of similar to the way cities operate today.
Michael Smith is the director of the ASU Teotihuacan Research Lab in southern Mexico. Michael, thanks.
Well, thank you.
Was the 19th century English thinker Thomas Malthus right about anything? He assured us there'd be too many people in the world and not enough food for them, and we'd lead short lives of famine and misery. He's become a bit of a joke, but there's at least one distinguished historian who thinks we should take him seriously. She's the author of The New Worlds of Thomas Robert Malthus, Alison Bashford. The BBC's science editor Tom Fielden went to meet her.
Here we have one of the copies of Malthus's essay on the Prince of Population. This is the 1803 edition.
In a small wood-paneled annex to Jesus College, Cambridge's 17th century old library, Alison Bashford, the Vere Harmsworth Professor of Imperial and Naval History, introduces me to the Malthus collection.
So we have all of Malthus's books here, and many of them he researched when he was writing and rewriting his famous essay on the Principle of Population. The most famous book on population ever written and ever likely to be written.
Quite some billing. But for many people, Malthus's essay is front and centre in the pantheon of politically unacceptable reads, an intellectual fig leaf for imperialism, exploitation, and genocide.
One of his great inspirations was Benjamin Franklin, and that book's here.
And that's a shame, according to Professor Bashford, who argues with Harvard's Joyce Chaplin in The New Worlds of Thomas Robert Malthus that he's been the victim of historical misappropriation. His reputation blackened by a subsequent association with fascism and eugenics and a hard-hearted disdain for the fate of the poor.
Everybody recognises the name Malthus and have some sense in which it's about limiting population. And that's where the great controversy, of course, with Malthus lies. But this, for me as a historian, just didn't match what I read.
A political economist by training, Malthus was interested in the relationship between population growth, which he argued increased exponentially, and the availability of resources, including food, which developed more slowly. The resulting mismatch led to disaster when checked by nature in the form of famine and disease, or by man through war or infanticide. Poverty, Malthus argued, was inevitable.
It's clear that he was naming something as it happened, telling us the way things are, that numbers of people would grow or diminish according to the amount of food available. And populations are limited by very unpleasant things. You know, people die through infanticide, through starvation, through killing each other, through war and through disease. All these, none of these things he wanted. But he was describing that as the way he saw it happening, as a principle, as a kind of a law. But what is then not often understood is that he was deeply engaged with the question of how might we ameliorate that. And that's why he's so unpopular and was unpopular at the time.
At this point, I should probably admit to something of a conflict of interest. For many years, Malthus was a professor of political economy at the East India Company College, now the school, Haileybury. When I was a boy here, it was a school unapologetically steeped in its imperial history, with houses named after alumni like General Allenby, the Viceroy of India, Lord Lawrence, and Rudyard Kipling. But there was no Malthus House, and indeed never any mention of his name. I didn't even know of his connection to the school until I read Alison Bashford's book.
There are many treasures here. My own treasure that I'm pulling out now is Malthus's own copy of James Cook's Voyages.
Malthus's remedy to reduce the surplus population was undoubtedly of its time. But what emerges from the new worlds of Thomas Robert Malthus is a much more nuanced picture of the man, concerned about the fate of indigenous peoples. And his analysis of the ebb and flow between population and resources still has resonance today.
He would be shocked by everything that happened through the Industrial Revolution, but he would still say, my thesis holds because there are still limits. And were he with us talking right now, I think he would say, look in my book where I said the whole world is like an island.
So you think Malthus would be a champion for the environmental movement, for sustainability, if he was alive today?
But well, he would be very interested in the problem, that's for sure.
That was historian Alison Bashford speaking with the BBC's Tom Fielden. The University of Arizona's ambitious mission to send a spacecraft to grab a soil sample from an asteroid is a first for U.S. planetary exploration. The spacecraft is scheduled to head into space on Thursday. From the Arizona Science Desk, Sarah Hammond details the mission.
The mission is called OSIRIS-REx, and its aim is to go to an asteroid named Bennu, map the half-mile-wide asteroid's surface, and then sweep up a dirt sample and bring it to Earth. That will take 7 years total. NASA's Gordon Johnston explains the need for the mission.
Bennu is a carbon-rich near-Earth asteroid that holds the record of the formation of the solar system and can answer some fundamental questions about the origins of our solar system and our planet.
The spacecraft will get at least 60 grams, or 2 ounces, of material from the asteroid's surface. The instrument has successfully collected 300 grams in tests. The sample return capsule can hold more than 4 pounds of the rocky material, which scientists call regolith. OSIRIS-REx was conceived 12 years ago by the late Michael Drake, then head of the U of A's Lunar and Planetary Lab. He chose a young meteorite scientist, Dante Loretta, to be his deputy. In 2011, several months after NASA decided to fund the mission, Drake died, and Loretta was selected to take over. He explains the scientific quest.
OSIRIS-REx is bringing back samples closer to home, and probably the likely candidates that deliver these key prebiotic compounds to our Earth, and help us understand why we are here, how we are here, and how likely it is that this kind of process, origin and evolution of life, may have occurred elsewhere in the solar system and even throughout the galaxy.
In layman's terms, that means asteroids may have contributed critical elements, including carbon and water ice, that led to the emergence of life. The scientists will use the spacecraft's instruments once it reaches the asteroid and sends back signals to study it from top to bottom, side to side, a process that will take 2 years. The gear on board includes cameras built by the U of A and a spectrometer provided by Arizona State University.
We're going to get to asteroid Bennu, and we're going to map this brand new world that we've never seen before. We've got an extensive suite of cameras, we've got our laser altimeter from the Canadian Space Agency, the spectrometers, and the spacecraft itself.
Loretta says the main purpose of the mapping is to pick the best spot to get the soil sample.
We're really going to understand the distribution of materials across the surface of that asteroid, which is going to be critical for characterizing regions of interest on the surface and ultimately making that key decision, which is where on this mountain-sized asteroid in space are we going to go down and get those precious 60 grams or more of material for our science.
Before OSIRIS-REx gets to the asteroid Bennu, a lot must happen. The countdown to launch is underway at Cape Canaveral.
Status check.
Go Atlas.
Here's
go
what will be happening in the next 3 days.
T-minus 5.
Today, the team is conducting its final launch readiness review.
4.
Today and tomorrow, the science team meets to go over what will happen in the next 12 months and discuss activities once OSIRIS-REx arrives at the asteroid in 2018.
3.
Tonight, everyone involved with the mission will gather on Cocoa Beach for a party.
2.
Early Wednesday, the fully assembled launch vehicle, the two-stage rocket, and the booster with OSIRIS-REx atop will be rolled out to the launch site and fueled.
1.
Thursday, launch officials and meteorologists will watch the sky, anticipating the moment when the engines of the rocket are ignited and
liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket.
Reporting from Cape Canaveral, I'm Sarah Hammond, for the Arizona Science Desk.
School is back in session, which means students are back to hitting the books. And increasingly, authors of books for young adults are addressing an issue some students and their parents would maybe rather not think about, school shootings. ASU professor Jim Blassingame has been reading up on this emerging genre. He's also executive director of the Assembly on Literature for Adolescents of the National Council of Teachers of English. And Jim, when did school shootings really start showing up in young adult lit?
It's not completely new, but it has just, I hate to use the word exploded lately, but there are so many more books coming out. We go back to just before Columbine with a book by Mel Glenn, Taking of Room 114. Then Columbine happens. These things have just kind of mushroomed in just the last few years.
Unfortunately, Columbine was not the last school shooting. There have been many, many more since then. Have you seen this genre sort of evolve as we see more school shootings and more different situations involving school violence?
Yes, absolutely. And in the history of young adult literature, what were taboo topics until The Outsiders in 1967 just blew it all open? What were taboo topics like violence and sex and LGBTQ issues, they have become more and more prevalent and more accepted, as well as people come to realize that we can't ignore these things.
The flip side of that, though, is even though there have been a number of high-profile school shootings, there are still a lot of schools in this country that have not experienced some kind of violence. So is there a danger of sort of freaking kids out that somebody is going to, you know, bring a gun to school and take out a bunch of their classmates, when in reality, the odds of that happening are still fairly small?
Well, let me say this. It's more likely that if a person who is emotionally disturbed reads about this in a book, that it will be therapeutic for them. Hundreds of thousands of letters come in every month to authors, and the letters that they get say, "Thank you for telling my story. I thought I was the only one in the world, and I feel so much better now."
High schoolers and young adults, as you well know, have a very high, for purposes of radio and a family show, let's call it a fake meter. Like, they can tell when something is not real, is sort of being made up or being glossed over. How closely do authors have to keep that in mind, specifically when they're talking about this particular subject? Because I would think there's sort of a fine line between getting too gory and too graphic in a story about shootings and death and violence, while also making it realistic enough that kids will read it.
That's absolutely right. That's a very good point. And it's all about how it feels. The authors who are successful, John Green, The Fault in Our Stars, Laurie Hall Sanderson, Speak, they know how to appropriate the voice of an adolescent. They know what that feels like. They get back in touch with their 15-year-old, 16-year-old selves. And as they're writing about this issue, it doesn't sound like, looking back, as in a memoir, with the advantage of an adult perspective, but it sounds like a teenager is telling this story.
In these young adult books about school shootings, are there any sort of trends that you see as far as from whose perspective the story is told, or the kind of action that is taken, or the kind of the ways that some of the people who are left behind respond to what has happened at their school?
Absolutely. There are some things going on there. One would be, what are the consequences of this shooting? What's the aftermath? Who suffers now? And also, the books are looking at, how could this have been prevented? What led up to this?
So do you think that these books, in some ways, while, as you say, can be very helpful and therapeutic for the young adults reading them, could they also hold some clues for adults as far as trying to sort of get inside the minds of the students that they're working with?
Absolutely. Parents and teachers, especially. In fact, there are 57 school shooting books out there right now that are just from within the period just after Columbine. And in Goodreads, a lot of the reviews now say, this is a good book for teachers to read.
Jim Blassingame is a professor at ASU and executive director of the Assembly on Literature for Adolescents of the National Council of Teachers of English. We were talking about the emerging genre of young adult literature dealing with school shootings. When it comes to medical treatments, most of us trust or perhaps take for granted that government regulations keep things in check and everything available to us in a doctor's office or a hospital has been thoroughly vetted, but not so fast. Case in point, neighborhood stem cell clinics. They're popping up across the U.S. They're offering patients access to experimental treatment for a huge range of issues, anything from facial rejuvenation to lupus or ALS. These clinics are taking advantage of what some people call a loophole, but Todd Bookman from WHYY's The Pulse reports the FDA may be about to crack down.
Smack dab at the top of the homepage for the California-based company Stemgenics, there's a video testimonial. It stars Sharon and Warren Hudson, who explain how stem cell therapy reversed some of the damage caused by Parkinson's disease.
When Stemgenics came into the picture, suddenly there was the discussion of getting better. There was the discussion of finding ways to alleviate the symptoms.
The couple detail how the procedure eased his mobility issues and allowed Warren to continue driving.
Let me tell you that there's hope out there and that there's so many ways that the treatment can help you, and we're living proof.
The Hudsons clearly believe in stem cells, and they aren't alone. Some background here. These are not the controversial kind harvested from embryos. These cells are instead usually extracted from the patient's own fat through liposuction or from bone marrow. They're then isolated and re-injected into a joint or the bloodstream, where in theory they do what stem cells are so valued for doing, which is regenerate and replace damaged tissue. But proof from randomized clinical trials, the type of evidence we demand for other drugs, doesn't yet exist. That hasn't stopped Stemgenics and more than 500 other for-profit stem cell clinics in the U.S. from marketing these treatments directly to patients. Joshua Graf Zivin is a researcher with UC San Diego. He likens the rapid growth of these clinics in the past few years to medicine's Wild West.
In essence, I can put out my shingle and offer certain types of stem cell treatments, and I can claim that they cure anything from joint disease to MS to Parkinson's without there being any real scientific evidence to substantiate that claim.
The list of conditions goes on and on, from Alzheimer's and arthritis to buttocks augmentation and male pattern baldness, all advertised as treatable with stem cells. Because they are your own cells and considered minimally altered, the FDA has been slow to regulate.
And if you look at the websites of these organizations and if you look at the claims by these organizations, they're really quite deceptive. And so I am very dubious that patients that go to get their joint pain treated at a stem cell clinic really understand how much of a crapshoot they're undertaking when they go to that clinic and drop $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000.
And that gamble isn't just if the treatment will yield results. Even though they're marketed as safe by many clinics, some patients have had negative reactions. Charles Crome is a sports medicine physician with a practice in southern New Jersey. He provides a range of services, including stem cells for joint ailments. Crome says he sees results, but is upfront with patients about the risks and unknowns. He worries others in his field aren't doing the same.
In any profession, there are good and bad. There's good presidents and bad presidents. There's good lawyers, bad lawyers, good doctors, bad doctors. Unfortunately, there are physicians in this country and throughout the world who are making claims about stem cells that just aren't scientifically proven. And it's unfortunate because they kind of ruin it for the rest of us.
The FDA is holding public hearings later this month on proposed new guidelines that could crack down on direct-to-consumer clinics. But some patient advocacy groups are opposed, saying stem cells offer hope when they've exhausted other options, and that they can't wait the decade plus it takes for pharmaceuticals to work their way through the standard approval process.
100%. I mean, I know that this is something that's helped me, and I really do think it should be available to people across the board.
Jennifer Ziegler lives just outside of Austin, Texas. She's undergone stem cell treatments on three separate occasions, and each time she says she's experienced symptom relief. She bristles at the thought of the FDA limiting her access.
I mean, this is between one patient and one doctor, and we don't consider the cells in our body to ever have been a drug.
To that end, there is federal legislation pending, separate from the FDA hearings, that seeks to fast-track stem cell clinical trials. Janet Marchabroda is with the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank which supports the measure.
The bottom line for all of us working in this field is that we want patients in need in the United States to have access to safe and effective cell therapies. And we want patients to be protected from unsafe therapies.
There is clearly a balance to strike here between protecting patients without stifling medical innovation. What's unclear, though, is how direct-to-consumer clinics, which offer hope but limited proof, fit into that calculation.
That's Todd Bookman for The Pulse.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
And Mark, joining us now is a familiar voice on public radio and beyond.
Indeed. You may know Luke Burbank as a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or perhaps as a correspondent on CBS Sunday Morning, or maybe on his show Livewire, which airs each Saturday evening at 6 p.m. here on KJZZ.
But what you may not know is that Livewire is coming to Phoenix later this month, and Luke joins us now. So for listeners who may not know much about your show, the best way we can describe it, Luke, is sort of offbeat infotainment, but it's really about storytelling, and I know you love doing that.
I have been pretty much for my whole life kind of obsessed with storytelling, telling stories myself, hearing other people tell their stories. I grew up one of seven kids, and this was back in the day when everybody still sat around the dinner table every night, even though my mom's cooking was later declared a Superfund site. But we would get together, and all of us kids and my parents, we would all talk about our day. We would spin yarns. And that really went into some deep part of my brain. And so as an adult, as I've worked in different kinds of radio and television, I've always been really interested in what the story is. You know how sometimes you'll be, you know, waiting for your flight, and you go sit at the airport bar. You got a couple hours to kill. Maybe you order a beer, some wings or something, and some guy pulls up next to you and you're thinking, I don't know if I want to get in a conversation with this guy. Like, I just want to stare straight ahead at ESPN and just get through the next couple of hours. And then maybe you start chatting and he starts telling you about something that's been going on with him. And you get involved in some sort of story that maybe you didn't even expect. And you're riveted by somebody who you didn't even know existed, 20 minutes previous. I think stories are so powerful. And what we really strive to do with Livewire is tell stories in a variety of different ways. That could be a song that somebody's singing.
I think all of us in this business can relate to that. Different ways to tell stories really is the essence of what we do, especially when you paint the word picture here on the radio. And speaking of telling stories with music, you've got some of that planned as well, and a whole slate of entertainment for the folks who come see us September 22nd at the Herberger Theater in Phoenix.
We've got a guy named Ted Ramirez who's going to be our musical guest. He is the official troubadour of Tucson. Who knew Tucson had an official troubadour? But they do, and it's a guy named Ted Ramirez, and we're going to talk to him. His stories, a lot of them are his songs. A lot of them are actually stories about the Southwest and about his experience. So we think a story can be told through song. It can be told by Penn Jillette, who's one of our other guests. He's from Penn and Teller, the comedians. He's the one that talks, Phil, which we feel... which we figured was
important,
a good idea.
Important booking, yes. If you're going to take one, you need to get him.
Yeah, we said we need the one who's okay with talking into the microphone because this is, in fact, radio. So we got Penn Jillette coming on the show. He wrote a new book about how he lost 100 pounds. He used to be a pretty big guy, and now he's cutting a pretty svelte line. So he's going to talk about that. And we've got this guy, Justin Schmidt, who runs the Southwest Biological Institute. He's a scientist in Arizona. His specialty is bugs, and he has this book out called Sting of the Wild. And in the book, he has established a pain rating for just about every insect sting that you could think of, and some you haven't. And the reason he knows how much it hurts is because he's actually subjected himself to the stings of thousands of insects. So he's got a story to tell. So, it really is all about storytelling. I mean, that's the thing that keeps me, when I'm listening to public radio, that's what keeps me sitting in my car in the parking lot of the store that I went to pick something up at. It's because I'm hearing a story and I got to know how it ends.
September 22nd at the Herberger Theater in Phoenix. Is that correct?
That's right. If people want to get tickets, they can go to herbergertheater.org.
Luke Burbank, host of the show Livewire. You hear it on the weekends here at KJZZ. It's coming to Phoenix, as we just heard, on September 22nd. Hope you could be there. Luke, great talking to you.
Phil, thanks for having me, man.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.